The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful website building platform. As a Guardian podcast listener, it goes without saying that you're a clever clogs. The good news is that building your own professional website with Squarespace is easy. Whether the site you need is for a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog, getting started takes seconds. Go to squarespace.com today and show support for this podcast and get 10% off. Use the offer code Guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On the show this week, as the US government calls a temporary halt to experiments that can make viruses more transmissible or more pathogenic, we explore the pros and cons of that research and the impact the moratorium will have. Do the potential risks of these studies outweigh the potential public benefits? Also on the show, we'll have our pick from this week's science news, including a dim view of brain games and a 50-year-old dinosaur mystery is solved. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In the studio, we have Wendy Barclay, Professor of Influenza Virology at Imperial College London, Nicola Davis of Observer Tech Monthly, and Azeen Gureshi, a freelance science journalist based in London. Joining us down the line is Mark Lipsitch, Professor of Epidemiology at Harvard. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Hello, thank you.
We'll start with the US moratorium on risky virus research. Wendy, the White House has suspended funding for some types of virus work and has asked scientists who already have grants to stop their experiments. What's going on?
Okay, so this all stems from some experiments that were first brought to the public's attention in 2012. For some while, people in the science community had been aware that these bird flu viruses occasionally infected people but didn't transmit between people. And there's been a concern about what would happen if they did acquire such a property. And the two groups in question had performed experiments, which are now the types of experiments called gain of function, in which they'd taken the normal H5N1 bird flu and using a combination of what we call forward and reverse genetics, they'd ended up with viruses which did transmit through the air from one ferret to another. And we use ferrets as a sort of model for human beings in this experiment. And at that point, the findings of the research were announced and some concerns were raised. So at that point, influenza virologists involved in this kind of research and others called a voluntary moratorium, which lasted for a while. And the hope was that lots of discussion would go on and some decisions could be made about how to deal with this kind of research. There were a number of issues raised. Should the information be shared with the public, or should only a subsection of people know about this kind of work? And then after that, should this research even be done in the first place? The voluntary moratorium finished work was resumed without any real decisions, let's say, being made. But this latest announcement now from the US government sort of comes on the back of various groups coming together as a result of this work and expressing opinions about it. And in order, I think, for now, some really meaningful discussion, let's hope, to take place about the pros and cons of all of this and how to go forward from here, this imposed moratorium, if you like, on the experimental work and on the funding that could give rise to more of that kind of work has been put in place for about 6 months while the talking goes on.
So is this just about flu research, or are there other viruses that they're putting a pause on as well?
So at the moment, the document that's come from the US government concerns influenza, MERS and SARS. And these are two other viruses which emerge from animals and infect people, but don't transmit terribly well from person to person. In particular, the MERS from the sort of Middle East is currently a worry, but it hasn't yet sort of gained this function or evolved the ability for high transmissibility.
And what has prompted this? I mean, you mentioned that there were groups who were opposed to this kind of research, or at least raised concerns over this kind of work. But in the summer, the US had some pretty high profile incidents where they had their very high containment government labs had essentially mishandled some fairly nasty pathogens, smallpox, anthrax, H5N1 even.
Yes, that's true.
Was that a driver for this at all, do you know?
I don't think those incidents drove the concern. I think the concern was there before this, but some will say that the incidents underscore the concern. So obviously they play a part of the equation in the discussion here.
So before we go to Mark, what's your reaction to the announcement?
I suppose good and bad. I mean, the good news is that at last something is happening and perhaps we're going to move forward from here. The worry is that we certainly don't want any fast decisions being made. We don't want to end up in a situation where we have bans put in place for so many reasons. But basically, you know, science is about building knowledge and it should be ways to overcome these problems by making sure that we do things properly rather than imposing bans, which is a very negative way of dealing with this problem.
Mark, if I can come to you, you've raised concerns about these gain-of-function studies in the past. What do you see as the risks of doing it?
The major concern about the creation of novel viruses that are both transmissible and virulent is, should human error lead to a laboratory accident, the consequences could potentially go well beyond the individuals in the laboratory or their family members. The specific concern is really about viruses that combine these three features: novelty, so they're not already out there in humans, virulence and transmissibility. And while biosafety concerns have been raised by many people in the past and have been amplified over the summer with these incidents in U.S. government labs, really the concern of myself and my colleagues focuses on those pathogens where an accident could lead not just to a few infections, but potentially to widespread or even global spread of the infection.
So you think that essentially instead of preventing a pandemic, they may increase the chance of one happening?
That's right. That's the concern. It's certainly true that the laboratories doing the work at present, at least the ones we know about, are highly skilled laboratories with excellent containment facilities. So it's not that we're predicting that such an accident will happen. The most likely thing is that an accident, a major accident, won't happen. But the small risk that it does is something that becomes much more concerning when we're talking about the risk of a pandemic than the sorts of risks that we face whenever anyone works with a dangerous pathogen. So we basically have really focused on this subclass of experiments as one of many ways that you can work on dangerous pathogens, but perhaps the most dangerous one of those to the public at large.
So are you in favor of this pause? Is that what you were after?
I think the pause is very important, and as Wendy said, I think the deliberative process is equally important. There are many questions of risk that have not been properly addressed in a quantitative and objective sense. There also has been some discussion of what the potential benefits of these experiments are, but really no effort to come to some common understanding of what those benefits are, and in particular, whether there are other ways that we could achieve the same public health goals without creating novel, virulent, transmissible pathogens.
So what actually happens now? What's the process? They've got this pause. Something substantial has to happen now to address concerns of people like yourself, but also presumably to ensure that the science isn't suffering. What is actually the process that's going to take place?
I returned yesterday, or actually this morning, from Washington, where an advisory board for the U.S. government called the National Science Advisory Board on Biosecurity met to discuss this issue. They have been charged, along with the National Academy of Science in the U.S., to begin this deliberative process and to have it on several tracks. One is a formal risk assessment combined with a formal benefit assessment that would be done by an outside contractor under the guidance of the National Science Advisory Board on Biosecurity and the National Academies. And the other is a more broad public discussion involving the scientific community very broadly and also others interested outside the scientific community, for example, concerned medical societies like the European Society for Clinical Microbiology and Infectious Disease, which called for such a curtailment of this kind of work and risk-benefit analysis. So other groups that are not necessarily scientists have a lot to say about this ethicists have raised concerns. So there's really a need to broaden it beyond the people who know about risk and about virology to a much broader discussion. And that's what the National Academy process is designed to do.
But if a key element of this comes down to a risk analysis, there must be a kind of threshold where you and other people are presumably happy for this work to go ahead. And does that mean a 1 in 10,000 chance of a pandemic, or how do you deal with these numbers? I don't know how this is done.
Well, I think that's part of what needs to be worked out through this broadly engaging process. I think if someone told you that your work involved a 1 in 10,000 chance of causing a pandemic and told you that some thousands to hundreds of millions of people might die in that pandemic, depending on how bad the virus was, you would not do it. I think you multiply the probability times the consequence and you say that's too many lives being put at high risk. Others might disagree, but I think that's basically what we do when we consider other risky activities like nuclear power, in fact also coal-fired power, other sorts of power generation that cause small increases in risks to many people's lives. We have a standard that low probabilities of very major events can be considered unacceptable. But where exactly that line gets drawn is certainly not my decision. It's a societal decision. This is one fairly small piece of influenza research. The discussion in Washington yesterday spoke of perhaps 20 research projects being affected. So the question is not whether we do flu research or not. Certainly flu research must go forward and surveillance and other activities. It's really whether this particular kind of research is so important that it's worth the risk.
You've talked a lot about the risk of actually doing the research. What about the benefits? You know, at some point, we look at the situation that's evolving in West Africa with Ebola, and we look at the situation with MERS. You know, for the people who are living out there, this is, you know, the benefit may be big enough that they would argue that on the other side of the scale, you know, the benefit could outweigh the risk. I mean, we've talked there a lot about assessing the risk to the countries where the research is being done, but what about the benefit to the countries where, you know, the science may actually have a strong application?
Well, I mean, I definitely think that one of the arguments you use there, Mark, about the worry of release from a lab kind of does apply to Ebola. I mean, we work with Ebola in high containment, appropriate high containment. It's a very dangerous virus. It is human transmissible. And were it to be released, there is the possibility of a wider outbreak. But we still carry on research with Ebola. We just make sure that we're using it in the appropriate containment. And there we feel that the benefits of working with it, you know, are appropriate. Now, you know, it comes down to whether or not we can agree on whether or not there are benefits short-term or long-term in understanding how influenza viruses become transmissible.
On the Ebola point, I guess I would simply say that if, heaven forbid, there was a laboratory infection, as there have been in the past, in a developed country setting, the chances of a large pandemic arising from that and significantly enhancing the number of people at risk compared to the current ongoing pandemic would be very, very small. So I think it's a different case, and I'm supportive of ongoing research on Ebola. With respect to the benefits, I think that is the naughtiest question, the most difficult question to analyze, and the one that's going to get the most discussion. The way I think of it is that we have a whole portfolio of approaches that we use to mitigate and prevent flu. Some of those are research, some of those are surveillance to see what's out there. Some of those are development of new vaccines that don't so much depend on understanding the virus, but understanding the human immune response. And one of the many, many ways we can approach flu research is the gain of function category of experiments. So the question is not, do we do research on flu or not? Everyone agrees we should. And everyone agrees we should do a lot of it. The question is whether we should do a portfolio of research that includes gain of function and therefore by necessity less work on these other things, or whether we should do an enhanced portfolio of work in other directions that are also productive and not do the gain of function research. Mm-hmm. That's the real policy question. That's how funders think.
Yeah, I guess so. But I mean, talking as an experimental scientist, I mean, the best way to approach a problem is from many angles. You know, gain of function is one way that we approach this, but we do loss of function. We take the virus to pieces and we do different types of research. So I think we have to bear in mind that there are certain things that cannot be discovered unless we do this particular experiment. It doesn't mean to say that this experiment becomes the mainstay of what influenza virologists do. It just means it's one part of solving the bigger problem.
I agree, and I would say I'm not opposed to every possible gain-of-function study on any virus. I do think that there are some questions that can be answered only in this way. But I think there are some questions that can be only answered with all sorts of experiments that we don't do for all sorts of reasons, like ethics and budget constraints. We can only answer so many scientific questions. And the unique thing about these experiments is that they present, I would argue, a very large overall risk to society. And when we are thinking about what experiments to do and what experiments not to do, the risk has to be weighed against that. At the same time that we consider the opportunity cost that we could be doing other experiments more intensively or at greater levels.
One of the questions that this research really wants to get at is how do emerging infections transfer across a species barrier, say from poultry to humans when we're looking at bird flu? Presumably you need these gain-of-function studies in mammals, in the ferrets, to do that. Do you not? Because how else will you actually have the proof that this is how this virus will mutate to be transmissible in humans? Are there other ways of doing that other than gain of function?
I think there are ways of doing it that are safer than the current approaches. One would be to take viruses that are much more similar to human seasonal strains, but occur in birds. And if you did the gain of function in those, for example, then the pandemic risk would be much less because there would be existing immunity, and you could even engineer it to be less. You could also do it using some novel strategies known as molecular biocontainment, which have been developed to try to cripple viruses in humans while leaving them effective in ferrets. There are indeed a number of questions that you can only answer with gain-of-function experiments, but there are very few questions that you can only answer with gain-of-function experiments on H5N1, for example.
I agree with you absolutely, Mark, and you know I do, that what we need to do is to understand this from every angle, and working with the low-path viruses is an important component of asking the question, at least now we're in this position, whether or not the findings of the H5N1 studies apply to other subtypes and even to other viruses. So this is, you know, all good, and we don't have to do every experiment in this high-risk, highly pathogenic way. But going right back to the beginning with the experiments that sparked the controversy in the first place that were done in the highly pathogenic bird flu background, the argument given by the people who've done those is that if you'd have done the experiment in a lower pathogenic background and you'd got a negative, in other words, if the virus had not acquired transmissibility in that background, you would never really have been sure whether or not it would have been positive if you hadn't have done it in the high path background. So in order to answer that very first fundamental question, which actually people had been saying for some years, well, H5N1's never going to go transmissible. There's something about it which means it won't. And all this funding that we're pouring into developing vaccines and drugs for it is a waste of money. And that fundamental question, can H5N1 acquire transmissibility, had to be answered using that particular strain or subtype in that way. Having done that, I agree with you. We've discovered a few sort of real principles now, which we can go back and work with in much safer ways to repeat the experiment in a different background, to shore up our findings and to work out how to now move on and use those findings for the benefit.
When you use this phrase genetic background there, which some people might not understand, what do you mean by that?
I simply mean here that influenza viruses, as Mark's alluded to, come in many flavours, if you like. Some of them are seasonal flu viruses that cause mild flu or moderate disease in humans, but this particular class of viruses which we're concerned with in terms of the H5N1s are what we call highly pathogenic viruses. And they're highly pathogenic because of the genetic makeup of those viruses. So that particular genetic background of the H5N1 viruses was what the original experiments that sparked this controversy was used for. But nowadays, probably, you know, we could begin to understand those experiments more by repeating experiments in lower pathogenic backgrounds that would be less harmful.
The gain of function studies going on at the moment, Wendy, how useful do you really think they are?
In terms of the long-term benefits, you know, the argument given by scientists is that all knowledge is useful. You know, what especially in academia, of course, where I'm based, you know, we want to build the knowledge base. Okay, not at every cost, and I'm with Mark, we have to think carefully about this, but all knowledge in the long term is likely to be useful, and it's very, very difficult to measure benefit, which is one of the things that worries me extremely about the whole risk-benefit weighing up. On the other hand, you know, the short-term benefits of new information which has come out from these H5N1 experiments, I think, is being overlooked a little bit at the moment. I think that this work will help us improve our ability to make vaccines. It will help us understand where to focus our efforts on, not in terms of necessarily sequencing all the viruses out there, because as we know, viruses can evolve and achieve something in different ways, but it's about understanding the fundamental mechanism by which a virus acquires transmissibility.
So not looking for the particular mutations No. that cause a virus to take hold in a mammal and be transmissible. Do you mean the function that gives it?
Yes.
And that might be achieved
Yes.
in different ways?
So to be specific, I mean, the example I like to give about these particular experiments is the stability. One of the unknowns that came out from the two independent pieces of work that were going on in two different continents was that the viruses which became transmissible between ferrets through the air had become more stable. And looking back on that, that seems now a fairly obvious thing, but it's something that none of us had really realised before now. And that knowledge means that we could now look out in the field and with rather simple, what we call phenotypic tests that simply measure how stable a virus is, we should be able to see whether or not some viruses in birds or pigs are more or less stable and therefore have this trait of being able to transmit, or that maybe one step closer to being transmissible than some others. It allows us to prioritise, because we can't possibly generate pre-pandemic vaccines for every single subtype of flu that's out there. We need to have a kind of order list of being able to work out which ones are more threat than others.
Nicola?
Well, I was interested there when you're talking about the transmissibility of viruses and stuff. How does this feed into, you know, the parallel side of dealing with pandemics and such like, which is, you know, public health programs and that side of thing? You know, should we be siphoning more money into that side of things? You know, that's always been a big problem with sort of current outbreaks, with, you know, sort of just general public knowledge of how viruses spread and things. Is that actually where we should be putting our focus to contain pandemics?
I believe that you need both approaches. I mean, you know, what people like myself do in the experimental lab setup is to understand the mechanisms, the molecular biology, the molecular virology behind all of these things. And hopefully what we discover will then be applicable or inform public health. You know, it helps with the vaccines, but it may also mean that we understand that some viruses, like I say, are rather easily destroyed by an acid wash. And that could help, you know, advise people how to deal with an outbreak, for example.
I think Wendy and I agree on many points, and I think the stability discovery was a very interesting one that happened to come from gain-of-function studies on highly pathogenic flu viruses. I would say it was, if that had been known up front to be the goal, which of course it wasn't because you didn't know what you were discovering, it would have been reckless for the U.S. government to fund two different groups to do experiments on highly pathogenic flu when they could have funded three or four groups for the same money, because of less biocontainment need, to do the same experiment in low pathogenic flu and then in an extremely high containment setting check whether the result was general to highly pathogenic flu. Mm-hmm. There's a certain incentive to work on so-called hot viruses because you get a higher chance of being published in the highly reputed journals. There is no scientific reason why you have to discover everything in the high path strains first. It could very easily be discovered at lower cost and greater generality in other strains, and then go to high path if you absolutely need to.
Yeah,
that's a fair point, isn't it, Wendy?
It is a fair point, but that's said with the benefit of hindsight. You know, we didn't know what the result was going to be. And with hindsight, yes, these things could have been discovered. And I believe that labs are working now to try and validate those things. And one of the big questions is, should they be doing that even in the low path strains now? Because the wording of the government document from the US is not completely clear. But you know, that really underscores the whole point I'm making, that the problem is that with science, we conduct experiments and we don't necessarily know what the answers are going to be when we start them. That those two groups were funded by the American government to do this work based on their high caliber, their scientific record, and the fact that people thought that by giving them money, they would discover important things. Science is peer-reviewed in that way, and only the very best science gets funded, particularly in today's economic climate. So, you know, those decisions were made. Whether or not now different factors will come in about making those decisions, we'll have to wait and see.
Hey Mark, if this is well-regulated enough, done in a small enough number of labs, that can be made safe, can't it?
It can be made safer. But what would be appropriate levels of high-quality labs? I think everyone would agree that the CDC labs involved in the incidents last summer of potentially exposing people, several dozen people, to anthrax and cross-contaminating and sending out samples of the wrong highly pathogenic flu virus would have been, those are top-quality labs too. And so accidents happen because people are in labs. And as long as people are in labs, you can't say this lab is absolutely safe. And I again would say, if an experiment puts at risk one or two or three people, I'm willing to listen to arguments about, well, it's going to be pretty safe and it probably won't happen. But when the potential impact is on the globe, to people who are not even aware these experiments are being done, but could become infected in the event of an accident, then I think we need to think very carefully before we do it. The basic point, I think, is that unanticipated benefits are certainly why we do science. We know things will go in directions we can't expect and that will be productive. It's not a reason to pick a particular kind of science when there are 15 risk-free ways to do it and one risky way. You need a big argument for why that risky way is better than all the other ones. And that's what's at issue here and what needs to be discussed in the deliberative process.
Yeah, and I guess the scientific approach is to do it in many ways. The risky way is part of it, but the others are also part of it too, because that's how we build our knowledge, that's how we get confident in our findings, by, you know, taking many approaches. This famous story of the aliens coming to Earth and trying to understand how the car works, you know, you need to take it apart, you need to take photographs of it, and then you need to build it. There are lots of different approaches to make sure that you really understand how it all works. The risky viruses are the ones that we study and sometimes get funding priority, because we need to understand fundamental issues like, if a virus which seems to be very pathogenic under a zoonosis condition, where the person has been exposed to an animal and caught the virus directly from the animal, if that virus now mutates and becomes transmitting from person to person, will it carry an equal virulence or pathogenicity, or is there some compensation between those two factors? And that was indeed one of the motives behind these kinds of experiments. And that's terribly important for planners to understand that, because it's very difficult to have contingency plans for the natural evolution of viruses if you don't really understand these fundamental issues.
I think that may be one area where we disagree. I think that result, while interesting, is a single virus in a single animal model. We can't make public policy based on the fact that in one lab, one set of mutations seem to reduce pathogenicity. That does not mean that transmissibility trades off with pathogenicity. And even if it was done in 10 or 100 strains, that would not be a general fact that we could rely on. It's just not helpful for planning to know that in one lab, this is true.
Okay, but if it was in 10 or 100 labs and it was done with lots of different viruses and different approaches, one may begin to feel more confident about the advice that we were giving. And my understanding of how some of the planning goes on at the moment is that in the absence of any other information, everything is planned on, you know, a scenario with a percentage case fatality rate, which is kind of plucked out of the air rather than experimentally backed up. So, I mean, I would have thought that some information is better than none in terms of this kind of approach.
Viruses like the MERS virus and like the bird flu viruses, they didn't originate in America. Is this a factor in considering, you know, what gets priority in American research? You know, if it was something that cropped up again and again and was very common in America, would that change how you viewed it?
I think if it was common in America and cropped up again and again as a transmissible virus, I wouldn't be nearly so concerned because we would have population-level immunity. The creation of a strain in the lab would not be adding significantly to the total number of strains out there. The real concern is the novelty of these strains, going from nobody having, as far as we know, a virulent, transmissible, novel flu strain that could infect humans to having one in a lab where there are humans working is a big change. But going from, say, Ebola in tens of thousands of people in West Africa to Ebola in tens of thousands of people in West Africa plus three more labs is not nearly so worrisome.
Mark, just one more before we wrap this up. Isn't there a danger that by putting a ban or even a temporary moratorium on this kind of research in the US, or at least making researchers in the US or those funded by the US feel that this isn't research that the government really backs, could that not lead to a rise of these kinds of studies going on in other jurisdictions where maybe the regulatory framework and the facilities are even worse?
I think that's a possibility. The idea that people will flee to unregulated places is a little bit unlikely. These are the reputable people don't want to do their work in places that don't have proper biosecurity and biosafety. I think maybe a bigger concern is that it will just tend to slow this kind of research full stop. And in that case, I guess I would argue that every time funders make decisions, they prioritize certain kinds of research over others. And in the U.S., we fund a little under 10% of the infectious disease proposals that come to the National Institutes of Health. So another way of saying that is that for various reasons, ranging from budget to ethics to animal welfare and all sorts of other reasons, we decline 90% of the ideas scientists propose, and at least half of those are good ideas, maybe more than half. So we just can't do most of the work that we would like to do that would be scientifically interesting. And the question is whether we include risk as one of the factors in that calculation. But it's not like we can just sort of have a neutral science policy that does everything.
Well, I think we have about a year to wait for this pause before we know what the upshot of it is. Maybe when some decisions are made in the US, we can have you back on to hear what you make of it and whether you think it's satisfied your concerns, and Wendy, whether you think it allows you to still get on with your research.
Sure.
Mark, Wendy, thanks so much for joining us. You can read more about this research at theguardian.com/science. Let's have a look at what else has been happening this week. Azeen, you've been writing about brain games. What's the story there?
Yeah, so this story, there was a letter that was basically an open letter that was published on Monday, signed by over 70 neuroscientists, psychiatrists, psychologists, and cognitive scientists, claiming that these so-called brain games are not scientifically backed, and at worst, they can be exploitative. And so these are games that have gotten increasingly popular. They are online or tablet-based games that claim usually to work on sort of your working memory and sort of stave off either cognitive decline or, in the case of young children, help them to actually become smarter. And it's a huge industry. It's been growing a lot since about 2005 is when some of the bigger companies entered the scene. And right now it's about at $1.3 billion industry, and it's growing to, it's slated to be about $6 billion by 2020. What these scientists were sort of protesting against was that if you go to any of these sites, they claim the backing of science as sort of their hallmark. They say they're supported by over dozens of randomized controlled trial studies that are all peer-reviewed. But basically, these these scientists are saying that that's not the sense in the field at all. We are learning a lot more about brain plasticity, but we don't know how to manipulate that. And they're sort of jumping the gun on these sort of prescriptive products and making lots of money on the point of potentially exploiting certain populations. They particularly focus on aging populations, which are targeted, and say that they are basically exploiting the anxiety of an aging consumer base that is worried about cognitive decline and is willing to sort of shell out money on these products. What's sort of at issue here is, can getting better at a narrow task in a game transfer to bigger, broader effects in general intelligence? And these scientists are saying no, by all intents and purposes. Based on the research we've got now, that's not the case. There's actually a recent meta-analysis that sort of looked at 23 sort of very valid studies on this subject that happened last year that showed that there was no effect. So
essentially what you're saying is that doing the crossword every day, it gets you really good at doing a crossword, but it won't help you remember where you put your keys or, you know, whether you shut the fridge when you went out.
Exactly. Whereas these things are being marketed as, on the worst end of the spectrum, they're being marketed as potentially preventing or even helping to cure Alzheimer's, which is what I think the authors of this letter particularly took offense at.
And so just to be clear, are they saying that are they going as far as saying they don't think these things work, or are they saying that they don't believe there is enough scientific evidence for these companies to claim they do work?
Right. So the latter. Basically, they're saying that they're not ruling out that it might be possible one day to have something like brain games that can help you hold on to memory longer and stuff like that. They're not ruling it out, but they're saying the state of the science right now is not at a place where we can be peddling products that are this prescriptive and expecting people to think that it's going to make them smarter.
Ian, you've been writing this week about a dinosaur, very exciting-looking dinosaur, which very long arms. Can you tell me a bit about why this is an exciting discovery?
Well, what was interesting about this one was that in 1965, so nearly 50 years ago, there was a joint Mongolian-Polish expedition to the Gobi Desert. And one of the things they found there were these quite extraordinary remains of a dinosaur. It was just the arms and the shoulder blades, but the arms themselves were about 2.5 meters long. That's all they had. They had a rib and a couple of vertebrae, but it was a mystery, and they didn't have any other remains for this type of dinosaur in those decades. And so people were trying to figure out what this thing was. It was the Latin name they gave it, Deinochirus, actually means unusual, horrible hand. And they had this thing, and people were speculating on what was this animal? How did it live? What was its thing? And there was one guy who was convinced that it was a giant sloth type creature that sort of hung under the branches of enormous trees. This thing was a large animal. Now, what happened last week was that a Korean team was back in Mongolia and were looking around, and they found two more skeletons of the same species. By piecing these together, they can cobble together a full animal. And so these are 70 million years old. They've now got the vertebrae, the ribs, the rest of the legs. Some of the ideas of speculation that was out there in the past about what this sort of thing was is now been sort of resolved. It's a type of animal that looks very superficially like an ostrich, but with long arms. But it's much larger. It was about 6.5 tons and about 11 meters long, one of the ones they picked up.
And what else is unusual about this dinosaur? So it's got these enormously long arms at the front. So it's not like a T-Rex with your little diddy arms. It's got long arms. Why long arms? And is there anything else about it that was unusual?
Well, it just seemed to be in that niche, and it wasn't like the T-Rex, where you had these withered, tiny forearms. And people did wonder, well, you know, how did this thing put together? Because if the arms were that small, how big was the rest of it, sort of thing? But this animal actually seems to have spent a fair amount of time looking for food in water. It has a very long and flared snout. It's a toothless snout, and it could forage around probably on the bottom of shallow water with that. And they actually found evidence of fish remains in its stomach contents from this latest study. And it had big, wide hips and flat, broad feet. So it would have been a bit of a slow waddling animal with its standing on its back legs, with its large arms in front of it. And it wouldn't have been a sort of a sprightly, aggressive type, well, aggressive, but not a very speedy creature.
And it's also got this sort of sail on its body, sort of like hunchback. It's a bit of a Quasimodo dino, this. So what was that all about? Because there was another dinosaur not that long ago that also had an enormous sail on its back, and that was one that was found in the waters. So what does that tell us about this dinosaur?
That's right. The other one was called Spinosaurus, which was, again, one which they've an animal they've learned a lot more about in recent years. And these spines on the back, they run down the vertebrae, and they call them neural spines. And they form this large sail, as you say, along the backbone of the animal. Now, what was that for? I mean, it may have had some physiological purpose, but it may also have been sexually selected. And certainly with Spinosaurus, you could imagine, and certainly the paleontologists I spoke to said, well, you could imagine this thing in the water and supported by the water, and you would actually really just be able to see the sail and the head of this thing moving along. But there's still a fair bit of discussion over what those sails really were for. That's all we have for you this week. A huge thanks to Professors Wendy Barclay and Mark Lipsitch. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team here, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
The Guardian.